So we continue with our study of the Platform Sutra. Let's see. Last time we left off with the sixth ancestor leaving in the middle of the night and heading south, sort of a culminating point in his biographical story. That's section 10 in Red Pine's division of the sutra. I want to start tonight by backing up a little bit. I don't think I did justice to number 9, the previous section, just before he leaves. At the beginning of the third watch, which is more or less the middle of the night, the fifth patriarch called me into his room and explained the Diamond Sutra to me. As soon as I heard the words, I understood. That night, unknown to anyone, I received the Dharma as he transmitted the robe and the direct teaching to me, and I became the sixth patriarch. The robe is an embodiment of trust that has been handed down from one generation to the next, but the Dharma is transmitted from mind to mind and must be realized by people themselves. So the robe is important. It's a sign of ecclesiastical continuity and power, but the Dharma is something beyond the robe or other than the robe, which is transmitted from mind to mind, each person realizing it for themselves. And I wanted to refer to some of Red Pine's comments on this. Among the most important, for me anyway, of Red Pine's comments is the way he fills in from other versions of the Platform Sutra. When I first read the Platform Sutra a long time ago, the first translation of the Platform Sutra was from the Ming Dynasty text, which is a late text, several hundred years later than the one we're reading now. And it's full of, you know, many legends and stories, and it's a much more full text than this one, actually. But and that's the one that people read for many, many generations. But then, when they made the discovery in the early 20th century in the Dunhuang Caves of all this treasure trove of texts, they realized that much earlier versions of the text were quite different. So that Ming Dynasty version became kind of obsolete, even though it has a lot of the main stories that people remember about the sixth ancestor. So in his commentary, Red Pine often gives you some of that material. So here it gives a much fuller account of the discussion of the Diamond Sutra in the fifth patriarch's room. It says here, this is Wei Nung talking, when he reached the line in the sutra, you should give rise to a thought without being attached to anything. I suddenly realized that nothing in this world is separate from our own nature. So this famous line in the Diamond Sutra, give rise to a thought without being attached to anything, or another translation is a thought not supported by anything, meaning there's no object that supports the thought. There's no sense object or mental object. A thought just arises and passes away, unsupported. That line in the Diamond Sutra in the Ming version is the line that he first hears early on in the story. Remember when he goes into the wood shop and he hears somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. In this version, it doesn't say what he heard, but in the Ming Dynasty version, it's this line. You should give rise to a thought unsupported by anything. I think I mentioned that before. But what I want to do here is I want to read to you the next sentences, and I want to read them to you as a kind of guided meditation. because these are statements that the sixth ancestor is making about seeing into your own nature, which is probably the most important theme of the sutra. So I want to read these sentences and with pauses, right, so you can really breathe and contemplate these lines. And these are lines that he spoke to the fifth ancestor after he heard the Diamond Sutra line. I suddenly realized that nothing in this world is separate from our own nature. And I said, Master, how could I have guessed that my own nature was already pure? How could I have guessed that my own nature was already beyond birth and death? Beyond birth and death. How could I have guessed that my own nature was already complete? How could I have guessed that my own nature was already unshakable? How could I have guessed that my own nature could give birth to all things? So, all of these statements are true for the sixth ancestor and for each one of us. Those are sentences that describe aspects of your own nature. And our job in practice is to see into our own nature and to know that all those things are actually true of us, of our basic human nature. So, now back to the main text. So he travels on, and he's pursued by a fellow here called Huishun, who was formerly a general, and he was a pretty tough customer. I remember from the Ming Dynasty version, it doesn't say that here, and I don't think Red Pine refers to it in his notes, but I remember being really impressed in the Ming Dynasty version when this general, this really tough guy, is pursuing Huineng, and Huineng says, okay, I give up, and he puts the robe and the bowl down on a rock, saying to this guy, okay, you know, don't beat me up, go ahead and take the robe and the bowl. And so the general snatches it, but he can't lift it. It's too heavy and he can't pick it up. And that's when he realizes, oh, there might be more to this little guy than meets the eye. But in this version, it just says, I've come all this way for the Dharma. I don't want the robe. So I, Hui Neng, transmitted the Dharma to Hui Shan there at the ridge. He was ready to hear, and as soon as I spoke, his mind opened up. From there, the text now returns to the present scene, which is Hui Neng in this great assembly, about to talk to all these people. But there's more of the story that this text omits, and I'm again going to go to Red Pine's commentary. I'm on page 120 to fill in parts of the story that are left out. So he goes to a local scholar in a certain place who had an aunt who was a Buddhist nun named Wu Chinsang. And this Buddhist nun would always chant the Nirvana Sutra. And so Hui Neng, remember, who can't read or write, so has never read the Nirvana Sutra, he hears her chanting it, and I understood its profound meaning. And I explained it to her. And she said, how can you know what it means if you don't know how to read? And he said, the main truth of Buddha Dharma doesn't depend on words. And this caused the nun to really respect him and smooth the way for him among the people of that village. Later on, and this is a part that always impressed me, later on he goes to live with a bunch of hunters for 15 years, right? So he's the sixth patriarch, given the robe and the bowl, and he's living with a bunch of hunters in the woods for 15 years. Sometimes I taught them the Dharma, as circumstances permitted. Whenever they told me to take care of their nets, if I saw a creature in them, I set it free. So for 15 years he was, you know, setting animals free from their traps they apparently didn't notice, I guess. At every meal, I put vegetables in their pot, because he would rather that they wouldn't eat meat, you know, so he put vegetables in their pot. And they said, why are you putting vegetables in the pot? And he said, well, it's good for you. You should have some vegetables with your meat. So after 15 years, he said, well, maybe it's time to seek my fortune elsewhere. He has this obligation, right, to share the Dharma that has been passed on to him. So he goes to a temple, and at that temple, another master was lecturing on the Nirvana Sutra. And outside the temple, there was a pennant, and the wind was blowing the pennant. This is a famous story. And one monk said, the wind is moving. And another monk said, no, it's the mind. Another monk said, no, it's not the wind that's moving, it's the flag, the pennant that's moving. And they were arguing about this philosophically, and I stepped up and I said, it's not the wind that's moving. It's not the flag that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. And the whole assembly was startled by this. I forgot to mention that when the general was pursuing him, and they eventually caught up to him, in the Ming version and in many other versions, it says, this is a very famous line, one of the most famous lines in the Platform Sutra that's not included in our main text, and that's when he says to the general, when you're not thinking of good or evil, at that very moment, what is your original face? And that original face story is a very important koan in Zen. If you're not thinking good or evil, what is your original face? And usually it says your original face before your parents were born. That's the full koan. What's your original face before your parents were born? And here, when it says good and evil, it means, I think, mostly not so much morality, good and evil, sort of sounds like a moral question. I think it means any kind of distinction that would always bring up judgment and attachment. Any time there's a discrimination and a distinction, there's always a judgment, right? This side, this is good and that's bad. I like this, I don't like that, and so on. That's the trouble with discriminations and distinctions. The characteristic of them is attachment and suffering. So when you're not thinking in the way of making distinctions, which all thought seems to involve, right? Any thought you ever have seems to have discrimination and attachment involved to it. But when you're not thinking like that, at that very moment, what's your original face before you were born? Anyway, that's just some material to fill in. Now we're back to the present scene, number 12. He's talking to the people that are assembled there. And he says, I'm coming here today to talk to all of you because I have an ancient connection to all of you of many lifetimes. And I can really appreciate this. I think we do feel in the Dharma that we have a connection like that, right, of many lifetimes. There's a certain kind of uncanny connection when you make a connection in the Dharma. And he's saying to them, it's no accident that I'm here talking to you. We have a connection. And then he tells them to, you know, listen as much as possible with a pure mind, without judgment and critique. But just listen and take it in and see what happens. Then he yells at them. He shouts. It says he yelled out loud, good friends, you already possess the prajna wisdom of enlightenment. But because your minds are deluded, you can't understand by yourself. You need to find a truly good friend to show you the way to see your nature. And here he addresses them as good friends, and he says you need a good friend. So good friend, as I think I said last time, Kalyanamitra, means good friends in the Dharma, but it also means specifically teacher, who is, by definition, a really good friend, better than your other good friends, because the good teacher really sees your ultimate needs, not just your temporary personal needs, but your ultimate needs. And so that's why the teacher is a good friend. And you're already fine, but you need the teacher, it says here, to show you the way to see your nature. Good friends, Buddha nature isn't different for the ignorant and the wise. It's just that people are deluded or awake. When they're deluded, they're ignorant. When they wake up, they become wise. So somehow, we it's there already. Everything we have, everything we need. That our nature is clear already. We don't need any improvement. But we need a good friend to show us the way. And I think because of the double use of good friend, I don't think it just means teacher, I think it means others who are equally committed and serious about the path. Then he talks about meditation and wisdom, which, as you know, traditionally are two different things. You want to achieve wisdom, understanding, awakening. You use meditation as a methodology, as a method, as a training to give rise to wisdom. That's the usual understanding of meditation and wisdom. And Zen makes a radical redefinition of wisdom and meditation by conflating the two, which is something maybe you could say implied in the tradition, but never explicitly taught except in Zen. And particularly, this is the original place where that teaching is given. And here's what he says. Good friends, this Dharma teaching of mine is based on meditation and wisdom. But don't make the mistake of thinking that meditation and wisdom are separate, are two different things. Meditation and wisdom are one essence, not two. Meditation is the body of wisdom, and wisdom is the function of meditation. Wherever you find wisdom, you find meditation, and wherever you find meditation, you find wisdom. Good friends, what this means is that meditation and wisdom are the same. And this business of, you know, the body and the function, that's something I think that has roots in Chinese philosophy, I think probably Taoist philosophy, and the sixth ancestor being Chinese, you know, and is applying that kind of category to Buddhist teachings. And he uses it a number of times in the Heart Sutra. And I'm not sure I entirely understand it or the point of it, but I was thinking about it today, and to me it's a little bit like somebody says, what page am I on? I'm on page 10 of Red Pine, number 13, section 13. Somebody chatted that. It's a little bit like the body, our physical body, and our mind. You'd say the body is the body, and the mind is the function of the body. Because if there's no mind that moves the body around, then the body ceases to be a human body. It's just like a piece of meat. As long as the consciousness illuminates the body. The body, there's no consciousness separate from the body, and there's no body separate from the consciousness. And yet, these two things are the same, and yet we make a distinction between them. So that's kind of like what he's talking about here in terms of when he says meditation is the body and wisdom is the function. Fellow students of the way, be careful. Don't think that meditation comes first and then gives rise to wisdom, or that wisdom comes first and then gives rise to meditation, or that meditation and wisdom are separate. It's a little bit like the wind and the flag and the argument over which is moving which, right? Don't have that argument. For those who hold such views, the Dharma is dualistic. If the mouth speaks of goodness but the mind doesn't think of goodness, meditation and wisdom are not the same. But if goodness pervades both the mouth and the mind, if what is external and internal are alike, then meditation and wisdom are the same. The cultivation of self-awareness does not involve argument. People who argue about which comes first and which comes second confuse themselves. Unless you put an end to right and wrong, you will give rise to self-existent dharmas, and you will never be free of the four states. So, that sounds, you know, a little drastic, you know, putting an end to right and wrong. And I don't think he means somehow like there's not going to be any more right and wrong. I think he means, you know, we're all so obsessed with right and wrong. Am I right or wrong? And what is right and wrong? In other words, we have attachment to everything in our lives and about our lives. Like I said before, it's not just about right and wrong. It's about all these discriminations and judgments and attachments that we have all the time. Every little thing, every thought includes them. If you don't put an end to those thoughts, then you will give rise to self-existent dharmas. And there are no such thing as self-existent dharmas. There are only mutually connected dharmas, not self-existent, separate, independent dharmas. You will, if you don't put an end to right and wrong, you will give rise to self-existent dharmas, and you will never be free of the four states. self, the four states, being self, being life, soul. We all think, right, that we have selves, we have a life, maybe we think we have a soul, we have existence. But these are reifications, concepts that cause us to be attached to our lives and therefore make suffering. So somehow all of this is involved with our supposed distinction between meditation and wisdom. Wisdom is not something ahead of us that we're trying to get through our meditation practice. Wisdom is our meditation practice, which is always here. Maybe this is a crude way to put it, but which is always here at the bottom of our consciousness. The silence of meditation is always present at every point in time at the bottom of our consciousness, and that's wisdom already. It's there. So there's no difference between meditation and wisdom. They're both forms of that silence. And then next comes the passage that I gave a Dharma talk about on the opening day of the practice period, whatever it was, the 18th, I think, of September, a couple Saturdays ago or so, about one practice samadhi. So I'm just going to read this, and I won't comment on it because I commented on it that day. One practice samadhi means, and here, one practice samadhi just means being present, living the Dharma all the time. Presence, living the Dharma moment by moment. That's what he means by one practice samadhi. One practice samadhi means at all times, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, always practicing with a straightforward mind. Remember that? Straightforward mind. The Vimalakirti Sutra says, a straightforward mind is the place of enlightenment, and a straightforward mind is the pure land. Just direct, simple, meeting what comes without anything extra. Direct, straightforward. Don't practice hypocrisy with your mind while you talk about being straightforward with your mouth. It's not an idea. It's a way of being in the world. If you speak about one practice samadhi with your mouth, but you don't practice with a straightforward mind, you're no disciple of the Buddha. Simply practice with a straightforward mind and don't become attached to any dharma. That's one practice samadhi. So now he's criticizing people who think that one practice samadhi is sitting without moving in zazen, eliminating all the delusions, and sitting there without thinking at all. Perfect meditation. People think that's one practice samadhi. But he said, but if that were true, if our goal is to sit here without moving, totally silently, without a thought in our minds, then it would be the same as being dead. And it would be an obstruction of the way. That's not what he means by one practice samadhi at all. The way flows freely. Why block it up? The way flows freely when the mind does not dwell on any dharma. So when the mind dwells on a dharma, attaches to a dharma, meaning a thought, anything, a moment, when there's attachment and reification of that moment, identity, making with that moment, the flow of the Dharma is blocked, and the Dharma has to flow. Once the mind dwells on something, it becomes bound. If sitting motionless were right, Vimalakirti would not have criticized Shariputra for meditating in the forest. And that's another section. Red Pine quotes it in his commentary from the Vimalakirti Sutra, where Shariputra, who believes meditation is sitting silently, you know, without thoughts, Vimalakirti says, no, no, that's, you got it all wrong. It's not that. He says, so don't believe the people who tell others to devote themselves to sitting and contemplating their minds or contemplating purity, and that they shouldn't think. That is totally upside down. And this upside down, they turn things upside down with their attachments. And that's a phrase often used in Zen, and I really resonate with that phrase, because it's like regular life is the actual reverse of Dharma. It's the upside down, literally upside down Dharma. The way that people think life is, and they are, and the world is the upside down version of the way it actually is. So when you turn things upside down, it's no wonder that everything falls over, you know, when you have nothing but trouble. So he's saying, no, he's now saying, including all these Buddhist teachers who tell you to meditate and purify your mind and so on and so on, it's totally upside down. And he talks again about meditation and wisdom, likening them to a lamp, meditation, and the light from the lamp, wisdom. That's number 15 on page 12. Number 16 on page 12. Good friends, the Dharma isn't direct or indirect. So here he uses the terms direct or indirect, but this is the equivalent of sudden path and a gradual path. You know, a sudden awakening, you see it right on, right away, or little by little you see something. This text is definitely advocating a sudden approach to Dharma. Shenshu, you know, the head monk who writes the poem, is apparently advocating a gradual approach to Dharma, and the poem that Huainong writes is a direct approach. So here he says, the Dharma, though, is not direct or indirect. It's people who are sharp or dull. For those who are deluded, there is indirect persuasion. For those who are aware, there is direct cultivation. Know your mind and see your nature. That's the burden of this text. Know your mind and see your nature. That's Zen practice, he's saying. Know your mind and see your nature. For those who are aware, there is basically no separation. For those who are not aware, there are infinite kalpas on the wheel of rebirth. No separation, meaning it's instantaneous. For the rest of the people, there's infinite kalpas on the wheel of rebirth. And in classical Buddhist Mahayana texts, there's something like some funny, how long does it take for the bodhisattva to become a Buddha? It's something like 10 to the 21st power lifetimes, some outrageous number like that. Now, I actually think this is a little bit misleading and overly polemical, because I don't think he's saying, you know, that we smart guys have the sudden method and all the dummies have to just toil for, you know, all these lives. I don't really think he's saying that. I think he's saying that there are both these ways, and they are appropriate for various people depending on how these people understand and what their karmic roots are. And as I said, I think last time, Suzuki Roshi said very clearly, our path in Soto Zen is both. It's both realizing our true nature on a moment, moment after moment, and it's also gradually wiping the dust off the mirror. So we're concerned about being careful with our lives. It's both. And in fact, when you see directly, you see there's no difference actually between the two of them. Number 17. Good friends, since ancient times, this Dharma teaching of ours, both direct and indirect, has proclaimed no thought as its doctrine, no form as its body, and no attachment as its foundation. So no thought, no form, and no attachment. Now he's going to define these. What do we mean by no form? It means to be free from form. So it doesn't mean wiping away form and making form disappear. It means being in form, like we are all in form. We're in our bodies, in a physical world. That's form. But without being attached to the form, to be free within the realm of form. And what is no thought? Not to think about thoughts, which I think means not to identify with our thoughts. Imagine what it would be like to think the same thoughts that you always have anyway, but not identify with those thoughts. What would that be like, right? Same thoughts, exactly in the same order, but you didn't think that they were you. You didn't think you were responsible for them. You didn't think they defined you. They just came and went. That would be a really different experience, right? So that's what he's saying. No thought means to let thought freely flow without identification. And no attachment, which is everyone's basic nature. Everyone's basic nature is no attachment. How do we know that? Because there's not a person who ever lived who did not give up every passing moment. Right? Oh no, I don't want this moment to end. But still, they gave it up. It ended, and they gave it up. Oh no, I don't want to die, but they did anyway. Right? Because that's their nature. Letting go and non-attachment is everybody's nature. That's going on in us anyway. But we have another idea, and we're trying to prevent that from happening, every moment to be lost in that way. And of course, we can't do it, and it makes us miserable. So no attachment is everyone's basic nature. Thought after thought, don't become attached. Whether it's a past thought, a present thought, or a future thought, let one thought follow another without interruption. I'm not trying to stop thought. Sometimes the mind does stop thinking, and that's really nice. But then, probably something else happens. Like this morning, I wasn't thinking too much, but there was a whole bunch of crows. I thought to myself, it's just like people, you know. They're yakking back and forth to one another. Probably they're yelling at each other. And then, you know, one of them says, I'm going over here. And then they all go over there. And they keep yakking over there. And then they go over here and they keep yakking, you know, just like people. Well, I wasn't thinking about it much, but there they were. I could hear them. So it's always something, right? So let things follow one after another without interruption. Don't interrupt them. Once a thought is interrupted, because we attach to it, we identify with it, we worry about it, we start perseverating over it, once a thought is interrupted, then the Dharma body becomes separated from the material body. Now you're stuck with your poor human body and the Dharma goes somewhere else. When you go from one thought to another, don't become attached to any Dharma. Once one thought becomes attached, then every thought forever becomes attached. But when you let go of one thought, then you're free forever and ever. That's why no attachment is our foundation. So this is no complicated thing to understand. It's pretty simple, but it's hard to do because identity and attachment is so embedded in every experience we ever have that it's hard to even get a feeling for what it would be like not to be attached in that way. Then on page 13, to be unaffected by any object is what is meant by no thought. And again, I think this is a little misleading, kind of gives you a wrong flavor, I think. Because when you hear unaffected, it seems like he's asking us all to be like cold fish, you know, nothing affects us, you know. But I don't think he means that. I think he means don't be caught by any object. Let the object joyfully come and go and don't be caught by it. Don't think about nothing at all, because once your thoughts stop, you die and you're just going to be reborn somewhere else anyway and you'll have the same problem. So take heed. Don't misunderstand. Don't be mistaken about yourself. And don't lead others astray. The reason we proclaim no thought as our doctrine is because deluded people think in terms of objects. They think there's something there. They don't know that all dharmas are empty. They think there's stuff there. They think they are there. We think we are here. And the other guy we think is here, and the world we think is here, but it's not. And as soon as we think in terms of objects, we have erroneous views. This is a challenging teaching, don't you think? Because when you hear it, like, I think you can understand it, but you think, wow, you know, really? You could actually look at things that way? You could actually live that way? Is he serious? Can I make use of this teaching? What? Nevertheless, when this school proclaims no thought as its doctrine, those people who transcend objects and who don't give rise to thoughts, even though they have no thoughts, they do not then proclaim no thought. What does no negate? And what thought is thought about? No negates dualities and afflictions. So no thought does not mean there's no thought. It means thought without dualities and afflictions. Thought without objects. Thought that is free, not bound, not suffering, that just flows. And thought, that's what no means. And thought means thought about the original nature of reality. So every thought brings up the whole of reality. Every thought is absolutely profound. Even the most stupid thought, in its foundational substance, if there were a substance, there isn't, is all of reality. And reality, Red Pine tells us, is his translation of suchness. The word usually is translated as suchness. So everything that occurs, every perception, every thought, is a pure and pristine suchness, reality itself. When your nature gives rise to thought, even though you sense something, remain free and unaffected by the world of objects. So we live in this world, because there isn't any other world to live in. With our bodies and our thoughts and all these other people around and all these problems that human beings have always had, because Buddha was really writing about the same problems. You'd think, well, in those days, a long time ago, what kind of problems did they have? Maybe they had a famine or something, but they didn't have the kind of problems we have. No, I think human beings have these problems all the time. So this is the world that we live in. This is the Buddha world. This is the world of suchness. This is the world that we appreciate and love. Just the way it is. The Vimalakirti Sutra says, externally, be skilled at distinguishing the attributes of dharmas. In other words, this is not telling us to be like idiots wandering around the world with our head up in the sky looking at clouds all the time. It's telling us that we should be skillful at distinguishing the attributes of dharmas. That's why we might want to be skillful and active in our social and political lives, because we are skilled at distinguishing the attributes of dharmas, and so we know that it's total suicide and crazy to keep burning all the fossil fuels and wrecking the earth and all these species going extinct. It's unbelievably stupid, and we should not be doing that. We see that. We're skilled at that externally, and internally remain unshaken by the ultimate truth. When people get totally freaked out and despairing over the state of the world, it's because they only have the one side, distinguishing the attributes of dharmas. They don't have the other side, to remain unshaken by the ultimate truth. So he's emphasizing here in this text so far and throughout the ultimate side, the ultimate truth side, because that's the side that we are bad on, you know, where we don't have that part. So that's why he's emphasizing it. But it doesn't negate the other side of being skillful in living in this world of form. So I'm stopping there for this time. And thank you for listening. This is not so easy, right, to quote-unquote explain this. I'm not really explaining anything, you know. But we're reading it, we're contemplating it, and we're taking it in, and somehow or other we have an impression. So now we're going to go into groups in a minute. But before we do that, I would like to just say an orienting word or two about the groups, because I have to do this periodically, because always people are different. New people are always here. And I don't do it every time.
Recording stopped.
But we're trying to have as much as possible honest and intimate conversations in these little groups of two or three or four people. And that's not easy to do under any conditions. It's not easy to do like in cyberspace. It's harder, I think. It's also hard when sometimes we don't know the people we're talking to, right? Maybe sometimes it's easier that way, but often it's harder that way. And the people that we're talking to may be coming from a very different place. We don't know. Some of us have, you know, been doing this forever and ever, and other people are brand new to it. So we have to be very patient with one another. We have to be very trusting, and we have to, above all, be kind. We're not here to straighten anybody out. Everybody's here to talk about themselves, not the other guy. So remember that. It used to be fairly simple, because there was just a few of us in a room there. We knew each other well, and yes, new people would come, but almost never would a new person come who didn't stick around, and little by little we all got to know each other. Now on Zoom, it's weird, because anybody from anywhere can appear in the seminar, and we wouldn't even know how that happened, you know? So we welcome everybody. It's not that we're complaining about that, but it just means that the groups can be more diverse and a little bit less coherent than usual. So try your best to be honest and trust that the other people will listen to you generously, and you listen to them generously. And when you have your time, speak, but listen when the other people are talking. Also, again, this was something that we all understood before the Zoom moment, and probably people don't know this even, because it's hard to convey. The idea of the seminar is that it's actually a seminar. It's not a drop-in Dharma talk group. There's lots of great drop-in Dharma talk groups, including Green Gulch Farm Dharma Talk on Sunday, San Francisco Zen Center Dharma Talk on Monday, and now in the age of Zoom, you can go to Dharma Talks anywhere in the world. So when we started our seminar, we said, since people can do that all over the place, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to have a seminar. And that means people will be committed to being here for a while and developing a conversation. So the way it works is anybody, of course, at any time is welcome to show up out of the blue, because why would you commit yourself to a conversation? You didn't know what it was, you know? So you could come and check it out. So there's always some people here checking it out. But the intention is that once you come and think it's suitable, or you want to try it, that you would commit yourself to a topic. Usually it lasts a month. So we'll take up one topic for a month, and we would like people to stay for the month. Now we're in practice period, so we're on one topic all the way till the end of November. So yeah, we hope that anybody who comes and checks it out would feel like, yeah, if they want to participate, they would have some continuity and some commitment so that we could get to know each other. That's the idea. So probably you didn't know that. Maybe you did, I don't know. Many of us assume that. But I'm repeating it now, because I think some people, I came to my attention that a number of people don't know that. So everybody's always welcome, but that's the intention. So it's, in other words, not a group, say, hey, I feel like going this week, and then, I've got other things to do, but then maybe a little later I'll go again and go here and there. With a lot of groups, that's perfectly okay, and there's obviously nothing wrong with that. But the intention here is to develop some continuity and some conversation. Anyway, I'm sorry I had to say all that. It's really boring to say this over and over again, but I thought I should say it once in a while. So, groups of three. And here's the question. How do you understand, or maybe that's not the word, how do you experience, that might not be the word either, how do you hold in your mind this key idea of the sixth ancestor, this key teaching that he passionately wants us to understand, of seeing your nature and knowing your mind? How do you see that? What is that for you? Seeing your nature. And that was the subject of our little guided meditation. Seeing your nature. Knowing your mind. How do you see that? How do you understand it? How do you hold it? How do you try to live it? Or not? Okay? So, I will put people in groups.